hello, and welcome back to another episode of Minority Reports Podcast and Digital Series. I am your host, Mona Sheikh. You guys, we are getting very close to Election Day, and I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting very jittery, very nervous about the whole thing. I hope it goes the way us Californians are hoping it goes, or I guess most of the blue states anyways. But today I have a very special guest. I am very excited to have her. I came across some of her videos, a very, very funny comic from New York, and I was like, I gotta bring her on my show. So here she is, the very talented Liz Mealy. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh my God, thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. Some random strange chick hitting you up on Instagram to be like, want to come do my podcast? And you were like, sure.
It is way better than the other weird, strange people that messaged me. So I will take a woman being like, you're great. Do you want to talk over like some dude being like, what you doing? Here's my number. What you
want? Which you and I both know that we get all the time. The weird messages.
Yeah, they're all weird. It makes me laugh. Although my second favorite message, which I accidentally cultivated, which is people just send me pictures of their cat. So on Instagram, they like, it blacks it out so you don't get surprise dick pics. So if nobody knows, if a stranger, like somebody you're not friends with, it'll be a black box that says this has been, you know, and then you, every time you tap it, it starts to blur less and less so that if it looks like a silhouette of a dick, you don't, it's like, there's no surprise dicks. For me, I get a lot of messages with blacked out squares and I'm like, ugh. And then you unblur it a little bit, and next thing I know, I'm just like, oh, kitty pictures. So I get a ton of people that are like, hey, I feel like you would like my cat. Like, hey, this is another picture of my cat. Like, so I like those messages too.
Not to be confused with pussy shots.
Yeah, nobody's sending me that. I mean, I'm not dressed. Like, I'm dressed as somebody that would like other women to talk to them. But
I recently learned that. So I love this shirt. I love plaid shirts. I'm a straight woman, and I was hanging out in West Hollywood, which is I live in West Hollywood, and I was hanging out in West Hollywood with my very, with a lesbian friend of mine visiting from San Francisco. And I was like, she looked at me and she was like, you know that plaid shirts are like lesbian uniform, right? I'm like, shut up. No, they're not. She's like, oh, yes, they fucking are. And I was like, dude, I love plaid shirts. She's like, well, don't be fucking surprised if a woman comes and hits on you. I was like, at this point, straight men have murdered my self-esteem to a point. I'll take any kind of hitting. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I love plaid. That's the other thing is that you do – I think being a female comic, you give off a vibe that in general, and then I like plaid. And I just, at this point, I'm just like, I'm fine with it. Like, I'm fine with all. I mean, honestly, a bunch of lesbians tell me I'm funny. I'm like, all right, let's do this. I love compliments.
I'll take it all day, every day. Now, Liz, you started, like, I was reading your bio, and my goodness, you started off as a teenager. Like, you started off with, what, like 16? Mm-hmm. And you're a Jersey girl. So where in Jersey are you from?
Right outside of Princeton. So central Jersey. And I would, I actually started, even though I grew up in Jersey, I started in New York. So I'd take the train every weekend to do shows until I moved here when I was 18.
How were you getting into clubs at 16?
You get kicked out of a lot of them. Most comedy clubs have a rule that if they serve food, you can have people that are under 21. So just a lot of clubs will serve food, and that's kind of the, the way to get around that. I did get kicked out of a couple of clubs. I used to do a kind of makeshift comedy club when I was 16 that next door was a strip club, and you would see strippers walking through all the time, and it was 100% a 21 or over. And I would come with my friends, and we got kicked out at least 3 or 4 times when I was 16, and it was a waste of a trip and blah, blah, blah. But I would go anywhere that would put me up on stage.
How long was that trip from Princeton, New Jersey? Because Princeton, New Jersey is like deep Jersey. So from Princeton, New Jersey to New York City.
It's central. It's about an hour and 15 minutes on the train. And then, you know, wherever you'd go, like whether it was West Village or Midtown or whatever, you know, at another 15, 20 minutes. So you're talking about like, you know, 3 hours round trip to do is essentially Devitt's on stage, but it was me doing comedy, and it's all I ever wanted. And I was told I had to start in New York. That's where comedy was. And clearly New York was more accessible than California. And I don't know. It didn't feel out of the way. It didn't feel like a sacrifice. Like, I was genuinely always excited to come to the city. And I mean, even now I travel all over the world, and it's not like, you know what I mean? You're going off to Germany to do a show and you're not thinking like, this is a hall. You're thinking like, cool, I get to do stand up in Germany. And like, the way I feel about that as an adult is how I felt about doing spots as a teenager. Like, cool, I get to go to New York City and do spots. Like, I'm a comedian.
Right. Right. I mean, you started at 16. You've been in the game for what? But it's 17, 18 years now. Cause I think you have a special out.
Yeah. It's 18 years and was in March. So, I actually released my first hour, which I came out with 6 or 7 years ago. I released that for free in March as like kind of like a little anniversary / we're all quarantined gifts to the world. And then a couple months later, I released my newer special, Self-Help.
Right. The first one, the older one was called Emotionally Exhausting, right? Where Hari Kondabolu, Hari did the intro for you at the stage.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, he's very sweet. I know he recently had a kid. Is he now in LA or is he in New York?
So his girlfriend is from San Diego. And so because of everything with the pandemic and blah, 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 you know, originally that, you know, her parents would have come to New York for all babies. But, you know, New York at the time was the epicenter and it just didn't feel safe to be there and to have a kid there. So they decided to go to San Diego for 6 months. And so they'll come back actually soon. I think in like 2 weeks, they'll come back here. So, you know, we're really close. We actually don't live too from each other in Brooklyn. So that we've toured together for years and he's one of my best friends. So it's been very exciting because he's always wanted to be a dad and he's a dad. And I know he's probably the best dad already, but also like, you know, we're going through this pandemic. We're not touring. We're all the whole world, let alone comedians, are very unsure what the future is going to hold. And then he just had a kid in the middle of it, you know, and in a city he's not familiar with. And, you know, his parents live in New York and he's now with his kind of in-laws parents. Like, it's just kind of like everything about it was just like, I'm sure very stressful. So I talked to him yesterday and I was like, tell me what COVID tests I need to take so that I can babysit this baby. Like, I was just like, I'm going to be hugging it. I'm going to be Aunt Liz.
Oh, that's so sweet. Do you, is that like a thing in your family? I know both your parents are vets, right?
Yeah.
They're veterinarians. And so is that like an expectation of you that they have? I mean, well, I don't even know. I know you have this whole bit about some people think I'm Middle Eastern. Some people think I'm half black, half white. I'm thinking you're like of Italian descent.
Oh yeah, I'm super Italian. Mealy means honey in Italian.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. Because the first time I saw you, and I was like, "That's an Italian girl." I grew up in New York City. I know an Italian. I see one. Like, I know it.
Yeah, I'm very pale from being inside for very long, but for the most part, I have pretty olivey skin, and I have actually big curly hair. I straightened it, so I think the mixture of I have big features, I have a big eyes, a big nose. And then I have a big butt. Like, you know, there's things that I have that are big. Yeah. And then I have this big curly hair. I think in general, I read pretty ethnically ambiguous. But it's really like, it is kind of funny, though. It's always like an Egyptian is like, are you Egyptian? And then it's always like somebody Greek that's like, are you Greek? And then it's always somebody that's like mixed that are like, are you mixed? Like, it's Jews always think I'm Jewish. Like, it's that kind of thing where I can read a lot of different people. I think people East Coast, Jersey Italian, like it just kind of oozes off me. I always say like I bleed olive oil. That's very greasy.
That's very do you, I mean, I'm sure like before the pandemic, because pandemic has ruined everything. Before I get into that, your co-host for your podcast is Maria Shahata, who is Egyptian. I when I moved to New York to LA about 10, 11 years ago, one of the first female comics I ever met was Maria Shahata. And I randomly met her, I don't know where, and she was just like, you should come with me. And like, she was so sweet to me. And she like made me like she was like, you can tag along, and I'm going here and going there. And I remember once we were sitting having tacos at this place called Pink Tacos. It's like a big taco place here. I don't know if you've been to it in LA. It's very like kind of bougie taco place. And I remember sitting there, and we're sitting at the bar, and we're eating our tacos, and this bartender was really hot. And he turned around, and he was like big drinks, and he had like really nice arms. And I remember Maria going to me, she's like, look at his back. How good must he look shirtless? Look at that back. I'll never forget that. And I was just like, oh, you're a back girl. Oh, you like guys.
Yeah.
That's your thing.
Well, it's funny. Like, so Maria's Egyptian, and our baby, we've wanted to do something with our baby pictures because we look almost identical as children, because she's short. Wow. She's really short and, you know, could also read ethnically ambiguous and has big curly hair. And like, I'm the same, like, we can, I also stole her style, and, you know, I have no problem admitting that. I didn't know how to dress. I met her when I was 21. And so a lot of the way, not only are the physical clothes I wear her clothes, because she's like, you'll look better in this, or I know you'll like this better. But also, like, I would look at her, because we have a similar body type, and I'd be like, oh, she looks cute in that. I'm going to wear that. And then, like, anything, any kind of stock, because I truly just was like t-shirt, jeans, I don't know how to dress. And then I would look at Maria, and she would pretty much dress me like a doll. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I guess this is what I am. So, like, there is a little part of us where we've been close for 15 years now. And, like, we've just rubbed off on each other, both humor-wise, clothing-wise. I mean, she knows how to cook, and I still can't figure out how to cook. So there's some stuff that I'm fighting. But she's the best.
Maria's great. Does she live in Brooklyn, too? I don't even know. I know she has a British boyfriend, right?
She's in London. She's lived in London for 4 years now. So I met her when she was in New York, and we became friends. So I think she was in New York for like 3.5 years, LA for like 8, and then she's been in London for 4.
Wow. Well, I mean, the London comedy scene is London comedy. To me, the best comedy scene is New York comedy scene, hands down, in the world, New York. LA is, you know, it's okay. Yeah. It's all right. You know, you have a lot of studios here, so you go to a lot of like TV and film stuff. Kind of, that's kind of where you kind of, you know.
Yeah, but we both know where you go to be good at comedy and have good comedy audiences and like really appreciate someone's voice is in LA. It just isn't. Yeah. You go to LA to take your career to the next level. You don't go to LA to get better at comedy. They just don't have enough stage time, and they don't value the stage time the way we do. So I think New York is, you know, and I hope it continues to be, but New York is the best place to see comedy, grow as a comic, and just, it's hard, but you fucking get your chops, you get good. London is probably the second best place that I feel good comedy, good comedians, good writers, original writers, a lot of stage time, cares about the craft. The next place that I've noticed that I really liked was Sydney. Like, I was really blown away. Sydney and Melbourne, I was really blown away by their comedy scene, the comedians, again, just the stage time, the audiences, what I could get away with, how people perceived you. I don't know. Like, those are the three scenes that I was kind of blown away by.
Did you feel like you could push the envelope a little bit more in UK and in Australia?
Yeah, and some of that might be like fish out of water. Some of it is because I'm American and I'm visiting and I'm a guest and I'm shiny and new, you get the benefit of the doubt, or you get this kind of, you know,
like a pass.
Not even like a pass, like this perceived specialness because you're new, because you're from somewhere else, because you traveled so far, because you're not staying. But also, I think New York comedy has its own flavor. I just think it does. I think everybody's a little obsessed with New York because we're the base of most movies and TV shows, and most countries take in American television and movies. So I can tell a New York subway joke to somebody that's never left Glasgow and they get it. So I think I'm also lucky that a lot of American cultural references or my accent doesn't trip people up because they take in so much, because entertainment, the music industry, I can say Rihanna and I can say Avengers, the Avengers, and everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Right.
So I think that's also where I have the privilege as an American traveling, is that I don't have to fill in the blanks like somebody else. Like if you're from Singapore and you're coming to America, like I don't fucking know if you have a prime minister or a president or a dictator. Like, you know what I mean? Like, right. I don't know anything about Singapore as an American, but Singapore knows about Trump. Singapore knows about the Avengers. Singapore knows about New York City. So that's where American comics hit. To the point where, like, I've had UK friends come over here and I've had to be like, nobody knows what that, like, you have to change that in your joke. Nobody, like, your accent, you also have to slow down. You're fucking talking about biscuits too fast. Like, you gotta, so again, right. I can kind of be 100% myself and not really change as much because people are used to American culture because of movies and television.
Right, right. I mean, American influences. So, Grant, I mean, you've traveled a lot. I travel a lot because of work too. And you know, it was fascinating when I got to Germany the first time. I landed in Munich, and it was around Christmas time, and there was German rap playing. And like right outside the airport area, there was an ice skating rink, and these little German kids were ice skating to German rap, and I was just like, look at the power of the American culture. Like, it permeates, like, every culture around the world. Like, for instance, in India, there's a massive stand-up comedy boom, and there's a massive rapper boom. Like, there's just rappers everywhere, and you're just like, holy, like, it's so crazy because I have a lot of friends in India who, you know, who do comedy. And one of the things that I heard is that some comedians go to the open mic and they're like, how much are you going to pay me to do the open mic? I'm like, pay you to do the open mic? I was like, what kind of entitled? I was like, you would fucking get punched in the face probably if you do that shit in New York City. They'll probably just ban you from any place if you ever try to do that shit. It's quite fascinating to me. I mean, I feel like every time I come to New York City, I walk away a better comic every time.
Yeah, it's hard here. I think that's what I you know, clearly didn't appreciate it when I wasn't in a place where I could appreciate it. But for the most part, you know, I think it pushes you to be better. I always say New York City is like training with Usain Bolt. You're never going to be as fast as him, but by trying to keep up with him, it's going to make you better. And I think there's so many comics in general, and then there's so many brilliant comics that just being here, just to keep up, you get better.
That's right. That's right. No, I agree. Liz, what made you get into comedy?
I just love it. I still love it. Like, I was a teenager. I remember
traumatic childhood.
Of course. I mean, I was deeply sad and depressed, and the only thing that ever made me feel less alone and feel happy and feel like I could connect with people was comedy. Like, I knew we were a funny family, and I knew that being funny and like quoting SNL or quoting a comedian broke up the tension in my house. But I don't think I realized what the tension was. I just knew that everything sucked and I was sad and my family was sad, but we also knew how to like laugh and stuff. And so I think as a coping mechanism, as a way of survival, and as a way of just getting some kind of, I don't know, endorphins, you know, any kind of positivity, anything to kind of keep me out of a depression came from humor. And I first leaned on it just to feel better. And then eventually I was like, I want to see if I can do this myself. Like, I feel like I feel better in every situation I'm in when I'm the funny one. And it was few and far between when I was younger. But I knew I had some, I knew I made people laugh. I knew my mom's really funny. I think I knew my mom was funny, but I really didn't start appreciating her until like 5-10 years ago, when like I would talk on the phone with her and I'd be like, fucking mom. She's really like, me and my sisters all the time are like, did you talk to mom? This is what she said. And it's like, I don't know. Like, I worked really hard to be funny. Mom's just funny. Like, and my brothers and my, like almost all my siblings are really funny. I'm the least funny person in my family. And then I think my mom and my brother Sam are probably the funniest.
How many siblings do you have?
Too many. I'm one of five. So
you're like me. I'm one of five.
Oh yeah, what number are you?
Fifth.
Oh, I don't like you.
The only girl, the only girl, and the youngest.
Painful. Oh yeah, I don't like. I don't talk to babies. I'm sorry. I can't.
What number are you?
I'm number two. I'm mad at you. I babysat you. I raised you.
Oh, the middle child syndrome.
Oh, Oh my God. I'm still a fucking older sister parent. From baby to older sibling, I think it's 14 years. What's your gap? What's your older siblings?
Our parents apparently live near a train station. We don't have very much of a big gap. We're only like 2.5 years apart from each other.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So it was like, me and my older sister are 2.5 years. Then my younger sister is 5 years from me. And then I think it goes, Santa's 9 years and 11 years. So it's like it's the point where when Teresa went to college, Greg was four and didn't really know her, still doesn't, you know what I mean? So like, it's like I help raise my little brothers. Like,
yeah, absolutely. With that kind of gap, yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
that's a pretty big gap. No, with us, it was like for us, it was a little weird. We were immigrants. Like, I moved from Pakistan when I was 15, and my brothers, who are not that much older than me, were basically left to be my legal guardians in America because my parents never lived here. They just brought us here and then just dropped us. And they were like, have a nice life. Goodbye. And we were like,
Your parents went back to Pakistan?
Yeah, they just went back to Pakistan. They're like, you'll figure it out. And we're like, we don't know what to do. Like, what are we doing here? And you're just kind of left in this weird place where you have to go, like, fend for yourself. And, you know, and comes a lot of trauma, comes a lot of depression, comes a lot of bullshit that you basically, like, I literally spent.
Huh? To move here at 15 from Pakistan, like, prime teenage year, like, that is its own fucking trauma.
That's right.
I can't even, as you know, I spent 4 days in Karachi, and a part of me.
That's where I'm from.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it was culture. It was true culture. I mean, it was the sickest I've ever been. I definitely got food poisoning. Oh, yeah. I lost like 10 pounds. And the booker, Umar, his mom, like, you know, I got sick the second day. And so she made this big meal for us, I think the third or fourth day. And I couldn't eat it because I was like, I was really sick for like days. But she would make me like plain rice and stuff like that. And I would look at it and I was like, can I come back and I'm not sick? I love home cooked meals. His mom was amazing. But I really liked Karachi. I've never seen a wealth gap like that before in my life. Like that kind of disparity in wealth where somebody on the street is begging for what is the equivalent of a fraction of a penny to the booker pointing out houses that are worth 17 million. So like in my mind, I'm like, cool, I can't afford to live in Pakistan either. Like, I'm like, I can't get real estate here. I can't get real estate where I live. But I loved it. It actually inspired me to, cause I have a lot of fans in India, and I've met a few Indian comedians, and clearly there's some connection with Indians that like my comedy, because I get so many messages from people in India just saying how much they relate to me and like what I do. And that's actually how I knew about the boom. But I was brought over for the Pakistan tour. He did it for about 2 years where he'd bring American and UK comics over. And I was blown away by how many female comics were doing it out there, young female comics, like just like really working hard and writing. And, you know, they would do it. What's the language?
Urdu.
So it would, what frustrated me is I would be watching these young comedians and they would do the setup in English and the punchline in Urdu. And I was like, no. I'm paying attention. I was like, what'd she say? They're laughing. What'd she say? Like, so frustrated. I was like, hey, you do it either all in English or you do it all in Urdu, but you don't fucking mix and match. I can't keep up. But you know, clearly the people coming out to see me, it was kind of so funny where it's clearly more wealthy people coming out to see you, but every single person was like, oh, you're from New York, I went to NYU. Oh, you're from America, I went to Boston University. Like, it felt like everybody coming to the shows had been to America for their education, or they had been to America for stints of time and had come back. And it, like, it just felt like this weird, it felt like I was like almost on an army base more than being in another country, because everybody's like, yeah, New York City. I went there for 2 years, you know, when I was in college. It's great. And then I think, I mean, it was most scared people were for me and the most unsure I was, because it's such truly like the most foreign place I've been. I don't want to say that PC like, but like, it's just unlike any place I'd ever been. And then even the booker, like, I remember being frustrated because I was the only woman on the tour. And because I was the only woman on the tour, we could only stay in certain hotels because there are only certain hotels that'll let women and men be in the same hotel. And also there were places we couldn't go, just in general. And I remember asking him, I was like, why can't I, like, because I love roaming around. Like, I was in Thailand and, you know, Malaysia and, Philippines, and I was roaming around. I was like, why can't I go roam around? He goes, you know, it's Pakistan is a lot safer than it used to be, but there's 25 million people in Karachi and it just takes one crazy, and I don't want to be responsible for that. And I was like, okay. I was like, that's fair enough. I would almost say the same thing about someone that's visiting New York City for the first time and knows nothing, to be like, all right, man, if you're just going to roam around and end up in Karachi, you know what I mean? I don't know if that's your great first day, but I was the person that was like, I'm going to go everywhere in the world, and I don't want other people's fear to stop me, and I don't want the unknown to stop me. And it was probably one of the most eye-opening and best trips I've ever had. And the guy that I always got my money exchanged with, because I've toured all over the world. So, you know, I always, wherever I go, I try to have a little bit of cash because you never know. And so I knew it was probably hard to get whatever Pakistani money there is, but I went and I was like, hey, I'm going to be, you know, in Germany, I'm going to be in this other places. I was like, do you have like Pakistani money? He's like, no. Why? And I was like, cause I'm going there. He goes, why? And I was like, well, you know, you see me every couple of months exchange money. It's cause I tour and I do comedy. He's like, where are you going? And I was like, Karachi. And it opened him up to the point where he was like, this is a man I've been like, you know, that kind of like, hey, how are you doing? Yeah. You know, whatever. You barely ever ask questions. This dude for like 4 years. And now he's like, yeah, where are you going this month? Like it like, and I was like, oh, because I went to his hometown. We have a bond. And it just made me happy. Like, there's just some places that people just don't feel like you'll ever connect with, or they won't ever feel seen. Because, like, if you're not going to some Scandinavian country or somewhere that feels typical in a lot of ways.
Did he give you some free cash because you went to his hometown?
No, but he does get me, like, sometimes, like, if I'm waiting in line or whatever, he'll be like, let her go. Like, he likes me. Now, it's now been a year, and I feel like I wasted our friendship.
They're like, give me some of that free cash, man. Like, Oh, man. And did you do comedy in Mumbai?
No. So my goal, it's funny, before all this stuff happened, I was just starting to figure out how could I get to India. I have a friend of a friend. There's a young comic that I met that grew up in India, and then I met a friend of a friend who is a stewardess that comes to New York all the time because she's the flight from Mumbai to New York. And so we went to a wedding together, and we like really talked about it and like how we'd go about it. And I think so specifically for Pakistan. Oh, did I break up?
No, not at all.
Oh, I just see a pinwheel. Okay. No, I saw a pinwheel for a second. So specifically for Pakistan, like somebody put the tour together, they picked us up, they helped us with all the paperwork, they did everything for us to do it. And I don't always need that for some European countries, you know, especially with the US, like, you know, you can just go to Germany. You don't need a visa. You don't need, I mean, this might all change with fucking Trump and stuff, but for the most part, Europe, we're able to just go. You know, clearly different. And so I would want somebody to help kind of do stuff for me. Like same with like, I've been trying to go to South Africa for years, and that's, I really want to go, but there's different things that you need, visas, affidavits, like all the kind of different stuff in certain countries that I would need kind of help with. Same with like when I went to Australia, like you need to prove that you have health insurance, you need to get a work permit, blah, blah, blah. So I want to do it, you know, clearly I was hoping, you know, this was a year ago, I was hoping that it was something that would happen in early 2021. Now, if it happens in 2023, I'd be grateful, but it is on my list.
Touring everything is just, I know that New York City was a ghost town, and thank God you got, you know, Governor Cuomo has been able to flatten the curve a little bit. And I know that one of the things that actually kind of freaked me out that I heard about New York City is that I know that at capacity, it's like 25% capacity that you can sit inside the restaurants, but they have outdoors open. I'm like, in the middle of a fucking blizzard? Like, who's having soup in the middle of blizzard outside?
Yeah, I mean, today's like been some of the worst rain we've ever had. And, you know, my show was canceled and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, clearly people aren't outside. Everything is weather related now. Right. Because we're, I mean, even 25% capacity didn't open up until a couple of weeks ago. So we were doing everything outside, and they're going to hold and they're going to allow people indefinitely to keep things outside. So I think it's clearly going to be temperamental. They're getting little heaty lamps. I mean, Norway, everything is outside all year round, and they're just little, like, you know, ski bunnies of people. So I think in some ways we're trying to mimic that for a safety precaution, but you know us, like, if we don't like it, we're not going to do it. And I think things will open up a little bit more, but also I think because we're still, you know, it isn't a ghost town. We lost 500,000 people. We don't have tourists and people aren't driving in for work, but it's still pretty fucking busy. You know, I've been on some trains that are edging on packed. I've, you know, been in parks that look like you can't social distance. So, you know, we're still millions of people in a small area that I think Como has every right to hold precaution so that, you know, in a lot of ways, we've done it better than most people. You know, we were hit hard, but yes, if we were our own country, we haven't had a second wave yet. You know what I mean? And the rest of the world, the rest of the country either never solved it. California never solved it. And most of the country is having their first wave right now and getting hit really hard, even though they had more preparation, more science, more understanding than we did, because we were slammed with probably in February without knowing it. So, you know, you can look at us and be like, oh, New York was the epicenter and what, blah, blah, blah. But we learned about it when the rest of the world learned about it. We didn't know it was in the city. We were very saturated and we did the best we could with the information we had. But if you're in fucking rural Oklahoma and you're just starting to flounder, it's like, dude, you've known about this for 7 months. You could That's be right. social distancing. You could be wearing a mask. You could, you know, have these other precautions, and you decided that you were better than it.
Yeah, I mean, I live in West Hollywood, which is in LA County, and my neighborhood, especially West Hollywood, had the highest rate of COVID cases in all of LA County. And wow. We were just like, are people just having fucking parties indoors? Like, what is happening here? Like, do you guys not know we're in the middle of a freaking pandemic? Like, just stop. So I think it finally is under 500 cases a day now. Finally it's dipping. But then on top of that, we have fires. We have the Silverado fire that happened. I mean, California has been on fire, man. I mean, everywhere you turn. This past weekend, Orange County was on fire. I mean, people had to evacuate. It's just, California has been hit really, really hard between the fires and the pandemic. I mean, businesses are just, I mean, everywhere you go, it's like just businesses are shutting down, and it's really heartbreaking, you know? As far as like shows for you, and you said a show got canceled for you. Like for us, so I have, I just landed hosting a show at the Comedy Store. It's a storytelling show, and we're going to do it tomorrow. So it's going to be all very socially distant, and, you know, we're going to be far from each other, and just a handful of audience sitting outside. Like, none of the comedy clubs are open in New York City, right?
Yeah, so we can't, for Como, for whatever reason, and they're, like, suing Como right now, and they've held rallies and all this stuff, but, like, for whatever reason, comedy is not allowed back. Jazz isn't allowed back. Like, these small venues, mom and pop small venues aren't allowed back, which doesn't make sense because it's like, well, comedy's not necessary. Well, nail salons are open. Bowling alleys are open. Like, how are they any more necessary than comedy? And at the end of the day, people came to New York City for entertainment. It's food, entertainment, shopping, and murder. I don't know why else to come. But, you know, you come for the adventure and the scariness. And the fact that, you know, Broadway has millions and millions of dollars, but they charge thousands of dollars for you to see a show. Comedy is like $20. Like jazz is $20. So I think they're really doing a disservice to one of the reasons why people even came here in the first place, or the people, you know, you can shut down Broadway, but the ushers can't survive without it. The ballerinas can't survive without it. The actors. So it's like, I'm on unemployment and freelancer, and I'm grateful they allowed freelancers on unemployment, but they're saying they're going to cut us off in December. And you're just like, yeah, to what? To what job? Like, right. What are we doing? So it's just a little bit like, I do think that Cuomo has done a decent job, but I also think he's being a little negligent that if you're going to make these people pay rent, mm-hmm. if you're going to make them pay their employees or try to stay open, then you need to help them with, you know, some kind of package or something, because, and as well as the performers, because this was a city of artists and you're not supporting us. So it's been all closed down, but we've pivoted and we've improvised. So up until literally New York Comedy Club just made the announcement that the park shows are over, but from July until now, until today, there's shows in almost every single park in New York City every single day of the week. And that has been amazing. This is one club in the city that has put on, let's say, seven shows a day in different parks, anywhere from 6 to 7 days a week, and paid us. They paid us like $25, which isn't a lot, but we never made a lot to begin with. And then also it was just a place to work and get their name out. And it was life-saving. And then the stand has almost like these big garage doors. So you would perform in front of the open garage doors, and then they put chairs out in the pretty much the bus lane and the sidewalk, and you would perform for people on the sidewalk. New York Comedy Club rented out some rooftops to private buildings, and we've been doing these like speakeasy rooftop shows in different parts of the city. A bunch of independent people and independent bars and cafes in Bushwick and all around Brooklyn have been doing the same thing on rooftops. So there's all, I've been calling it comedy speakeasies because it's all illegal. We're technically not allowed to do it, but you know, everybody's in survival mode, and it both creatively and spiritually, it's been the thing that's kept me going. It's been awesome. Yeah. And the positive spin that I've put on all of this is I remember reading when I was a young comic, and before I started doing comedy, I was obsessed. I would read these biographies and these books about comedians in the 70s, like doing stand up in LA and like living out of their cars and, you know, at the Comedy Store in New York, they're at Catch a Rising Star, and you know, we're all living in the same room and everybody ate peanut butter and jelly, and like just the kind of gritty survivalness of comedy. And it was such a starving artist story. And now I'm like, I'm part of comedy history. We were fucking on rooftops and in driveways and in people's backyards and in gardens and in parks, telling shows to squirrels and strangers get by and just to entertain everybody who was scared. And it was, still happening clearly, but I think it's slowing down a little bit. But to go from Zoom shows to park shows to whatever is next, I'm really proud of New York City. I'm really proud of my community.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in LA, it's been very interesting where, you know, I produce a lot of shows. This podcast and digital series, of course, I was already shooting them in Vegas because I have a co-producer there and have a studio that I would go and shoot there. But then because of the pandemic, everything shut down and, you know, we lost the studio and everything. But I was doing all these live shows that I've been doing for the past 5 years under Minority Report brand. And it's fascinating because everything got switched to Zoom. And all of a sudden, I have comics that I've been booking are like, I don't do Zoom comedy. I'm just, I'm above it. I'm like, you're fucking above Zoom comedy? Like, this is all we got right now. Just take it, you know? Yeah, there's been a lot of that. I mean, I don't know. Did you kind of had a hesitation in the beginning to be like, I'm above Zoom? Like, this is.
I didn't think I was above Zoom. I just didn't think I would enjoy it. And I wasn't wrong. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't fun.
Yeah.
It's exhausting. It's not as rewarding. And you and I both know, you do a joke, you have a joke pre-pandemic that kills, like truly kills. And you're like, this is why we do this. Like, it just, you're hit in the face with laughter and you're like, I'm a fucking star. I'm a fucking genius. And then you do it on Zoom and it feels awful. It might be getting laughs. People might be smiling, but I don't think people understand the high of really connecting and getting hit in the face with laughter. And the same joke to get this like dribble of a response is hurtful. It's insulting. And it's not why I got into comedy. So I had to really lower my expectations, and I had to if anything, I wrote my ass off and I wrote a lot of new material. So I never knew what the actual response was.
Yeah.
So that if I do a new joke and I get this like, huh, that's funny or ha ha ha, then I'd be like, oh, I guess that's all that joke is, as opposed to the older stuff that I knew was killer and it's getting garbage response, making me feel bad about myself. So then fast forward, I start to do the Zoom jokes that I had made. I do them in the park and I realize they're not that strong, or that they're really strong and I wasn't getting the response from them, and I have a new excitement for comedy again. So there's a part of me that's like, I tried to use Zoom differently than I used live shows, and that's what helped me do them and appreciate them for a different capacity of writing and performing.
Yeah. We have a question here from James, my one of my big fans here, James. He said, question, does Zoom comedy throw off your comic timing?
100%. It's so weird. So like, don't get me wrong, there's people that sneeze or drop a, you know, a waitress drops a glass, somebody shouts out, somebody laughs too loud, too weird, too long after a punchline. There's so many things that can throw you off. But for the most part, you're a group of strangers, this group think happens, and for some reason, a whole bunch of strangers decide at one time that you're not funny or that you're funny. It's almost crazy how often it's seamless. Yeah. But when everybody's in their own little box, in their own little home, with their own little mics, it's, and you're wearing ear, you know, headphones and stuff, it's such a disjointed response, and you're hearing it in surround sound, and then someone's always vacuum cleaning for some reason, and there's always a baby strangling a dog that's yelping, the weirdest sounds that you're not prepared for that are happening in this ear while somebody's like, you know, I didn't really get that joke. Did she mean litter box or littering? Like, you're just like, what is, so you're actually distracted so uniquely in such a different way that I found I didn't really wait for laughter, and that I think my new jokes are a lot more rantier because of writing them via Zoom, because to pause for laughter wasn't A, as rewarding, but B, it was just so distracting and weird and discombobulated. Right. You know, this person over here in Wisconsin's laughing, this person over here in California's laughing, this person over here is yawning or smiling, I can't tell. Like, it's just, there's no groupthink the way there would be. And there's some influence because everybody can hear each other if they're all their mics are on, but it's just different.
I just, you know, I've experienced, am I echoing on your end?
I don't feel like you are.
I feel like I've done some Zoom shows where like you're sitting down and I feel the energy so different. Like when you do the Zoom shows, it almost feels like you're doing comedy in a vacuum, and you're right. You're like jokes, you know, like just killed, and you do them again and you're like, you know what? You don't deserve that joke. I'm never going to do that for you, Zoom. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Not for you, because you hurt me right now. I'm not
the last time I'll let you hurt me like this.
Yeah, it's just like, no, this is turning into an abusive relationship and I don't like it. I'm like, no. But I the one thing that I've noticed is that I did this one show and it was all comics, and they have like these very high end, like paying custom, you know, their favorite fans, and they pay an extra $50-$100 just to watch the comedians exclusively and just to hang out with the comedians in like the green room, right? And these are like whatever, like rich people who come and like to watch this exclusive kind of. And they were just like, we want you to do the comedy standing up. And I had to put a bunch of books to elevate my laptop and, you know, to have it on eye level. And I had the best time. And how that whole show worked is that, no, you know, it all depended on how hard you killed, and everybody's mics are on. If they're all comics, nobody is, you know, they're all producers and comics, and you know, they're private clients, and they're, nobody is allowed to have a, you know, a crying baby or a, you know, a dog getting choked to death, like none of that shit, right? And it was crazy because the harder you kill, the more money you make. Like, you see the money coming in, like people donating on every joke that you do. And to me, that by far has been one of my best experiences thus far. But other than that, like, doing jokes in a vacuum. I did a show for India, 150 people tuned in for that. And that was just weird. It's just like rows and rows of just boxes. And you're just like, this is the most awkward shit ever.
You know? Feels very futuristic where like, you decide somebody's fate from the comfort of your home. Like, should she live or should she die? Yes. And then people are like, die. And you're like, oh, give me a second. Like, yeah. Let me prove myself to you. Like, I just feel like a jester in the future. And people are just like, no $5 Venmo for you.
They're like this or this. Yeah. It's very gladiator-ish, you know?
Yeah. So, but I learned to work with it. I wrote a lot of new material. I learned to have fun with it. I definitely had some really great ones. Like, it's, every, you know, I started my own Zoom show that I think I might even continue to do in the future if we get out of this soon, called Zoom Diner, which it's me and two other comics and we workshop new material. So we basically, like, I would do a new joke and then you would be like, oh, I really liked that. Or have you heard of this? Or, hey, I heard somebody have a similar premise to that. So to make it unique, have you thought about doing this? So you basically, it's this behind the scenes thing of, you know, what we do with friends sometimes, but it's in front of people. And I have young comics that love it from just a learning thing. But I also have audiences being like, I had no idea that's how much thought you put into these things or how long it takes. Like, I had this joke about, I had this joke called I Hate Math, just about a fan hearing me joke about it online and offering to give me free math lessons because he's a tutor, and just me going off about like how ridiculous that is. And it's this 3-minute rant about how much I hate math and how much math ruined my life because I'm dyslexic and also, you know, all that's, I'm just bad. And I did an early version of it on my Zoom Diner workshop and, you know, comics gave me notes and I revamped it. And I was like not happy with the ending of it. It was still pretty raw. And then I worked on it on my own. I did it some live shows on Parks and then I still needed some work to it. So I brought it back like 2 months later and I must've had a repeat person that had seen it. And he sends me $50 and he goes, I have to say, I didn't really enjoy your I hate math joke when you first did it, but I really see what you're trying to say now. And it's really come together and it's a really good bit. And I'm a math teacher. And he's like, I believe in you. Like, it was like really nice where he was just like, you kind of shit on how I make money, but here you go. Like, it was, and it made me feel really good. And it's now one of my best bits and one of my favorite bits to perform live. And it all spawned from this workshop show and forcing myself to have new, at first it was every 2 weeks because, you know, we were stuck inside. Now it's like once a month because there's less people inside. But I don't know. I've doing new material and, like I said, having it be this different type of atmosphere and low stakes also has been really helpful. And that's a show I would have never created in the real world that the pandemic helped me brainstorm and get creative with.
Right. You know, you were talking about shows in different parks. It's interesting. I didn't realize that comedy clubs were the ones who were booking these shows in different parks. You said there's a show going on in every park. We're having, we have the, you know, the Irvine Improv that's in Orange County. And they have, we have a lot of drive-through shows now. A lot of people pulling in their cars, a lot of drive-through shows. I went to a taping for Erica Rhodes. I don't know if you know who she is. Erica Rhodes is a female comic here. She had her taping of her special here in drive-through. And it was crazy because there's like, there's a giant crane with cameras all over. Then there's a drone that's flying around and catching. There's a massive screen that she's standing in front of. And that's what the camera is projecting. And instead of being like, where's my white people at and where's my Latinos at? It's like, where's my BMWs at and where's my Hondas at? And it was just so bizarre that we're identified by our cars. And I just think, you know, the Irvine Improv is actually doing these drive-thrus. Liz, you know how much they're charging per car to come and watch these shows?
$60.
$150 a car.
Wow.
Sold out, Liz. Sold the fuck out. I'm like, how much money do you motherfuckers have in Orange County? And why the fuck am I in LA? I need to move to Orange County. Like, $150 every show is sold out.
That's crazy. And it's also smart because at the very least, four people have to be, you know what I mean? You can't just have a car with one person, you know, they're charging per car. So what it's actually doing is making people convert. Because think about it this way. I do shows and I see single people come all the time, which I'm never going to shame a single person. I'm somebody that was a single person that used to come to shows. I support my friends that are in like plays and stuff as a single person. When I know they're like, you can't fucking bring a boy or like a roommate. Like, why are you going by yourself? But we know that when you do that, that takes away a whole table or that takes away. Yeah. So what this now does is because nobody can afford a 150 car ticket, is it goes, oh, I got to make some friends or I got to fucking start. So now they're the, what is it? The people that try to put fake tickets to people outside of like baseball games and stuff.
Well, you're talking about the scalping?
Scalping. So you're almost like a scalper for your own car where you're just like, hey, give me $20 and you can, I'll drive you to the show and you can watch a show. Like,
yes.
This, you've made them like, it's almost like an Amway scheme where you're just like, you sell to them and then they sell to you and then you just see some comedy.
It's a pyramid scheme for comedy tickets.
Yeah. So, I love the creativity and, you know, none of it's ideal, but it's also unique and weird and kind of fun. And as long as it stays temporary, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just feel, Liz, this is gonna, I don't want to be the one to say this, but I feel we're not going to go back to regular comedy for at least 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't think you're wrong. What I do think is going to happen is things are going to slow down because everybody's going to be financially crippled and not have, you know, the money for non-essential things. But I do think the wanting to get out, the wanting to do stuff is going to be there. And eventually there's going to be a live entertainment boom. But I think it's going to take a bigger dip than it already has first.
Yeah.
And then eventually come back
up. But you know what, Liz? I take offense to it when they say that artists are non-essential. Let's be fucking clear. Everybody's home watching fucking Netflix and Hulu. Yeah. And it's artists that they're watching. They're watching comedy specials of Liz Mealy. You know, they're watching comedy of Mona Sheikh. They're watching whatever. And it's artists. It's because of us. So it's interesting because in the beginning of the pandemic, this article came out. And it said about essential jobs and non-essential jobs. And the number one essential job was doctor. And the number one non-essential job was artist. I was like, is this article written by an Indian or a Pakistani parent?
Yeah.
What is happening here?
Well, also, think of it this way. They told people, stay home. If you want to be a good person, you stay home. And how do you placate people? Video games? See, you know, music, stand up, comedy, TV shows, movies. So there's a part of me that's like, okay, we entertain people so they actually stayed home and kept people alive. I know we're not the same clearly as, you know, nurses and people that worked at grocery stores and, you know, pharmacists and what have you, but it is so funny for a whole country to say, what's the big deal if artists don't survive? Well, I think the next pandemic, there's going to be a lot more murder. There's going to be a lot more people that don't stay home. Like, I completely agree with your assessment of like defensiveness because it's like, am I really not essential? Because everything people have done since they've lost their job is watch Netflix and HBO and Comedy Central and I'm interested to see how people treat, and I will say this in a positive light, people have always been very nice to me as people understand this is a risk job, right? It's a freelance job. You don't know when you're going to get opportunities. You know, people only know of like three comedians. So they're just like, well, if you're not Jerry Seinfeld, if you're not Dave Chappelle, or, you know, what are you really doing? And nobody really understands this kind of, you know, I call them like gig comics, like comics that make a living doing it are gig comics. If they stop gigging, they're not really making money. Mm-hmm. So nobody really understands us kind of gig comics, which is we make a living by traveling around the world and the city or in the country.
That's right.
But what I find fascinating is people have been exceptionally generous during this pandemic, knowing that it is dead. Even our backup plans are dead. You know what I mean? Like my backup plan, like the last jobs I had were 10 years ago and I was a babysitter. And before that, I was a receptionist. And before that, I was a temp. And before that, I was a waitress. And before that, I was in college. So, yeah. So what I find interesting is even our, oh shit, there's no job thing. You can't even do the receptionist job. So we're like doubly fucked. And people have been very thoughtful, generous, and have showed how appreciative they are for what we do, especially since we give out so much free content, podcasts, stand-up, bits, right. Instagram. So I've gotten a lot of people that have understood how crippling this is, both in a short-term and a long-term. And I'm very grateful for my fans. Like my fans, I can say without a shadow of a doubt, have kept me spiritually and financially together during this time.
No, that's wonderful. I mean, I think I have been forced to, I've been live streaming 5 days a week. I just hit my 76th episode because I've been live streaming. And I think that has just kind of become my kind of backup plan. And I've been very fortunate to have some of my fans kind of step up and be like, you know what, we're going to make contributions to you every week because of what you do and, you know, take care of you. And this is what we're going to do. One of my fans, actually, James, who I mentioned, was kind enough to send me whole like podcasting equipment.
Woo, nice. That.
Like shout out to James. James the best. But you know, it's, and you're right. It's because your fans are really the ones who are coming and like kind of uplifting you. And we're at least fortunate enough to have that. You know, some comics don't even have that. Like they don't even have access to that. So I'm definitely very grateful to it. But yeah, I take offense to it when they're just like non-essential jobs. I'm like, try fucking getting through your weekend without watching Netflix.
Yeah.
My brother was visiting. My family lives in Texas. I never lived in Texas, Liz, because I have taste. But my family moved to Dallas, and they all live in Dallas. And he was recently visiting. And, you know, they're all IT guys. They make really good money, and they do very well for themselves and stuff. But, you know, they kind of look at me as like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? Like, what is this? Like, why don't – my brother's like, why don't you just move to Texas? And I was like, can you buy me a gun that fits properly in my mouth so I can pull up the trigger? Like, no, fucking, I'm not moving to fucking Texas, you know? Does your family kind of hit you up and be like, come back to Jersey?
I think in an ideal world, my dad would want that. My dad really wanted, he had 5 kids and he wanted us to be like the Waltons in this like very like 50s.
Oh, your dad, you know, also?
Yeah, I think honestly, you know what's really funny, and I noticed this a couple of years ago. Most of my close friends are children of immigrants. Maria is, you know, her parents are Egyptian. Hurry, his parents are Indian. My buddy Prakash is from Singapore and he grew up in Singapore, but his parents are Indian and clearly moved to Singapore. I have a lot of friends. My friend Nitika is a parents of immigrants. Like, I have a lot of really close friends in my life. That they're, I think, would they be first generation? Because their parents grew up in a different country.
Yeah, first generation.
So my friends are first generation. And I'm like, well, that's weird because it would be my grandparents that were first generation. Not even, my great grandparents would be first generation for.
Oh, wow. Oh,
you know what I mean? Because it wasn't even, yeah, so it wasn't even my grandfather and grandmother. It was their parents. So why do I feel clearly so connected to first generation immigrants? And then I was like, because my dad is so fucking 50s. Like, he is like that, you know, you come here, you work hard, you sign your name to everything, you make, like, I mean, the fact that I, and my parents are veterinarians, so it sounds like they're not doctors, but they are, and they wanted us to be doctors. Like, that whole, like, you know, you're financially stable. You don't lean on your family. You take care of yourself. You take care of your siblings. Like, blood is thicker than water. You know, you don't embarrass us. Like, this, like, the fears that my friends have and the things that they can't shake and the things that make them still worried about their parents while they're in their 30s and 40s is very similar to how I feel about my parents. But my mom isn't like that. My mom could give a shit and was kind of like, checkout is 18. Please don't come back. But also, my dad raised us. So we had 3 girls first and 2 boys later. My dad raised us like boys, and he, and not in like an insulting way, but like he just kind of raised us to be extremely independent, strong women that we can change a tire and change a diaper. With the same, you know, my dad, I tell the story, I started telling it recently. my dad is weirdly has a lot of toxic masculinity and a lot of stuff that's a little like, even now I'm just like, fuck off, dad. But also my dad cooked, cleaned, folded laundry, changed diapers, always had tampons on. He used to carry a fanny pack on vacation because he had a wife and three girls. So he always had tampons hidden in the car, hidden in his bathroom, like was, you know, this, and I don't know if it's because he was a veterinarian and he dealt with gross things in that sense, that he just, my dad's the oldest of five and his mom was sick and in and out of hospitals most of his life and died when he was 19 and his dad was working three jobs. So he also has been a caretaker his whole life. Sure. But my dad raised us to be so uber independent and think for ourselves and figure it out ourselves that when I was like, I want to be a comic, my dad wasn't like, woo, go do it. But my dad was also our like, if you're going to do it, you're going to fucking do it right. And so he's always kind of scheming of how can I make my daughter more financially stable up until about 5 years ago when I became more financially stable. But up until about 5 years ago, it was always like, hey, like almost like, you know, those commercials that are like, did you know from the comfort of your home, you can make $2,000 a week? I'll show you. You just have to watch this video and give us their social security number. My dad was always kind of doing stuff like that. He's like, well, I talked to Sandra's cousin and she's doing this and she only got a BA. Maybe you could go back and get a BA and you could learn this thing and it only takes 2 years and then you could. And I was like, dad, I'm not doing that. He's like, what about becoming a personal trainer? You could do this and do it on the side. Dad, I'm not doing that. I don't want to back. I'm setting fire to the ships and I am going forward. So he worries and he is very like an immigrant parent in that sense, which is like, I didn't make all these sacrifices for you to fucking tell ha-has in a basement. But at the same time, there's still that American like, all right, if that's what you want to do, I'm behind you. I got you. So I'm a little bit in between my immigrant friends and my American friends where like I feel an immense pressure to be successful, not even in a aesthetic way, just in a financial way. But also feel like my parents empowered me that I could do anything I put my mind to. And the sacrifices they made were so that I could make choices they didn't have the luxury to make because they grew up poor and they came from really difficult homes. And, you know, my mom lost her dad when she was 10 and her mom when I think she was 19 or 20. My dad lost his mom when he was 19 or 20 and, you know, has some relationship with his dad, but not really. And I didn't really grow up with grandparents. And I think my parents kind of understand that they did it all on their own and they didn't want their kids to have to do it all on their own. And so my parents weren't perfect, but I have nothing but respect for what they've done. And you know what? Yeah. They made my older sister's a nurse and probably one of the smartest, coolest people you'll meet. My little sister is a jazz singer and songwriter and just a badass human. My brother, Sam, he's been in and out of hospitals. He's had a rough go of things, but again, probably the smartest person in our family, the kindest person and the funniest person. And then Greg is in law school right now and is going to fucking be clearly the most successful person in our family. But we're good. We're the type of people that you want when shit goes down. And yeah, my parents did that. And I think that's where I'm like, they did something right. Like, shit goes down in my friend's life or my sister's friend's lives or my brother's friend's lives. And they reach out to mealies. And that's kind of the thing I'm proud of with my parents. So they weren't like, yay, be a comedian. But I think now they're like, we raised you that this is probably one of the hardest things you could have decided to do. And we can see that you're living up to that challenge.
Yeah. It sounds like you're, parents, even though your dad is and your parents are, I don't know what, like fourth, fifth generation Americans, but they still have like the residue of that immigrant work ethic and that immigrant mentality of always be like, always find stability, always find certainty, always, you know, be able to stand on your own 2 feet. I think for me, like, I'm not even first generation, like Maria and Hari, I'm a straight up immigrant, like that. Who I am. And I think for my family, they have been in shock forever that I would even walk down this path. Like, who the fuck does stand-up comedy? Like, in my family, like, who's doing this? Why do you want to be an artist? Our parents, my dad's dream was that we were going to come to America, miraculously, Liz, we were here, and then miraculously, we were all going to go to medical school.
And
we were all going to just like wrap everything up and then go back to Pakistan. And then he was going to build us a hospital and we were going to run a family hospital.
How's that working out for him?
Well, he died. So
sorry.
Clearly that hasn't worked out for him, right? Clearly.
Did not have laughed that hard. I'm sorry.
No, please. I mean, but those are facts.
How did it work out, Dad?
How did it work out? Oh, sorry. You're dead. Sorry.
Sorry. So what are your, do you have four brothers?
I have four little brothers. I think in a way you can say that the dream killed him because it's just like, don't have weird fucking expectations of your children. Like, be grounded, be realistic about stuff. Like, you can't send like five children abroad to America and be like, figure it out, go become doctors, okay, go. And you're like, wait, what the fuck?
Like you get off the plane and they hand you a stethoscope. You're like, here's the American dream starter kit.
They're like, here you go. Here's a scalpel. Go cut a frog. Let's go. It's like, no.
So you said, are all your brothers in IT?
My oldest brother, I don't know what he does, Liz. Nobody fucking knows what he does. We keep away from him.
Yeah.
He's not the black sheep of the family. He's like he's the Ted Bundy of the family. So we just kind of keep away.
Okay. Okay.
And then there's the other three, and they're all IT guys, and they all do very well for themselves. They work for themselves. They're private consultants and, you know, really do really, really well for themselves. And then there's me. I think they look at me and I think my family did not respect me for what I did for the longest time, especially my mom. She was like, what is this hobby? What are you doing? You know? And I remember like the first time, cause I grew up in New York City and I used to live in Midtown West and then moved out to Brooklyn and stuff and grew up in New York. But I remember the first time I did my open mic, I did it at Comics Comedy Club and my mom came with me for my first open mic, which was.
Wow, which is a fucking risk.
What the fuck, Liz?
How old were you?
Oh my God. I was like 28, 29.
Holy shit. You're 28, 29. In her mind, you're like, you should be on your fourth kid.
That's right.
Like, you're starting this frivolous career that even an American parent would be disappointed in.
That's correct. And my mom, I remember, and you know what the craziest thing was, Liz? Because my mom's vain, right? So she has her like level of vanity. And I remember like doing my first like 3 minutes or whatever I did. And apparently I was doing really well. And she couldn't understand half the stuff I was saying because her English is not that fluent. And all she saw was people laughing and having a good time. And she was just like, that is my daughter. And people are fucking horrified. They're like, yo, you brought your mom? Like, I'm slinging dick jokes. I'm just, you know, bottom rung shit, right? When you start, like, bottom rung shit. And I remember getting off the stage and people were like, oh, my God, you brought your mom? And I'm like, language barrier is a beautiful thing. Don't worry about it.
He has
no idea what the hell I'm saying. And I think over a period of years, like, just, you know, fucking, you know, what am I preaching to the choir here? You know, you just like, you eat shit, you do the shitty room, you do whatever it takes. And I think it's not until I started like, you know, booking bigger shows and like, oh, mom, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to be headlining a show in Dubai. Oh, you're going to Dubai. Oh, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to be headlining a show in Portugal. Oh, you're doing like, and then that's when, oh, I'm going to be on SiriusXM. I'm going to be on iHeartRadio. That's when a little bit of the respect comes in. But for us, I don't know how it is with your family, but with my family, it all comes down to the financials. Like, did you buy a house? Do you own property? Do you have assets? Are you married?
No one's proud of you until it's, there's no risk involved. So, that's where it's kind of frustrating, both from a friend level to a significant other level to a parent level, which is, I don't fucking need you after it worked out. I need you to believe in me when I can't believe in myself. So it's always frustrating when you talk to somebody and they go, oh, what do your parents think of it? And they're like, well, they're proud of me now. Yeah, anybody can be proud of somebody that's now on TV because it's no longer scary for them. It's no longer a risk, and it's no longer a stain on they think their family name. As opposed to, I am very grateful that my parents, you know, I think they were scared and maybe they hid a lot of it, but they never got in the way and they never made me feel bad. And, you know, I'm doing this at 16 years old in New York City, a year after 9/11. And I'm at this point now, looking back, I'm like, did they even care about me? They just let me do that.
Yeah, that's crazy. But
yeah, truly. So I think I'm very grateful that my parents, even when things were bad, I was calling up, I was frustrated, I was disappointed, I was bitter, I was confused, you know, whatever. They were like, oh, okay, well, you know, you'll get them next time. And, you know, this happens and everything. And my dad was, you know, I'm dyslexic and my dad's dyslexic and he had 5 dyslexic kids. So my dad is this underdog story getting into vet school. And what I always appreciated about him was it was so difficult to get into vet school. It took him 5 tries because he has this learning disability. He didn't even really understand until my brother, Sam, who's number 4, had it. Even though all kids were coming up fucking dyslexic, he still was like, I know I'm off. And then it finally hit him how bad it was when the 4th kid, because Sam was actually the worst dyslexic. So when things have been going much better the last couple of years and I've had some kind of big breaks and some stuff that's propelled me forward and I've been more financially stable. But my dad, when I would call him up upset about something or frustrated, his thing was like, yeah, this is how it, you just got to keep doing it. It was never like you should quit. Like, I know he was always mealing, dealing, trying to get me to get a side job because he was worried about him dying and me fucking being homeless. But other than that, it was never like he doesn't believe I'll get there. It was just like, until you get there, here's a side job to make sure you pay your rent. And I think it's very rare in the arts to have family that
supports you.
Yeah. Sees your vision the way you see it. And we all know that we walk around, people think you have to have a big, you know, big dick energy and believe in yourself and a lot of self-esteem to get into this. I think it's quite the opposite. I think in doing this, you're looking for it. That's like right. I have the word courage tattooed on my back. I got it when I was 18 years old. And I think I've only started to really embody that in the last couple of years. I think I tattooed it there because I was looking for it and I was hoping I would have it. And now I look at myself as an adult and I was like, oh, I can see how brave I actually have been. And I can see how scared I was the entire time. Like there's a great quote that I'm going to butcher, but it's something about courage is in, you don't actually have to have courage. You have to believe that you can find it or something like that. I'm butchering the shit out of this, but like courage isn't always just there. It's one of those things that you have to believe is going to show up. And I think in a lot of ways, being an artist specifically, or being an entrepreneur, doing anything that doesn't have a safety net or a clear path, like a doctor, like a lawyer, like an architect, like an engineer, there's no, you go to this school, you take this test, you do this. When there's not a clear path and there's so many places you could fail and have nothing to show for it, people are scared for you and they project that fear onto you. And I think it takes, I don't know if bravery is the right word, but I think it takes a lot of gumption to go, I see that this is causing you stress and I am also stressed, but I'm not going to let your fear discourage what is essentially curiosity and pure guessing that I'm going to get to the other side of this.
Right. I think Liz, for you might have been a lot more fortunate with your family assistance or family, right, at least seeing your vision. Or I didn't have anything. I didn't have anyone.
I think, like, it's so much harder.
Nobody. Like, zilch. Nada. Not an ounce of support verbally. No financial support. I remember when I moved from New York to LA, I have like just kind of hustled and worked my way to whatever I am today. I started off, you know, working off as an assistant in finance in New York, and then kind of worked my way up to becoming an analyst. And you know, just fucking hustle, like just grinded my ass. Like I don't remember a day since I've stepped foot in America to not work. Like, I've just been working, right? And I remember I had saved up a bunch of money. I came here, and I was living off my savings for almost a year. I bought a car. I, you know, did all on my own, right? And I didn't know anybody here. I just picked my shit up and I was just like, I want to move to LA. Like, that's where I wanted to move to, because I had a manager at the time who asked me to move out here. And I remember I was like, literally, I had like run out of cash. So I called my mom up and, you know, I've always had a very tumultuous relationship with my family, very tumultuous. It was never a really healthy one. We always, there was a lot of violence in our house. There was a lot of domestic violence in our house. We never really had a good vibe with anybody. And I remember, like, I was just barely recovering my relationship with my mom. And I remember calling my mom up and being like, Ma, you know, I need $100. Like, I don't have a penny to my name right now. I need to put gas in my car. I don't have any money to eat. I don't know what I'm going to do. I've applied for this job, waiting for the job to come through, but I need the fucking gas to put it in my car so I can drive to the job interview to interview for it in order to get the job. But I need $100. And my mom was just like, well, you made the decision to go on your own. Now you figure it out. Right.
Wow.
And I was like, Mom, it's just $100. Like, I'll give it back to you. And she was like, no, you help yourself. Right. So wow. I like just being like, you know, it's like when people, you know, like Olive Garden has that commercial when you hear your family. I mean, I'm like, you mean treat me like shit and abandon me? I'm like, because yeah. That's what fucking family is to me, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's weird to me. And I have such a crazy thing that followed after that. I remember going to my bank and being like, you know, when you're so broke, you're so scared to go to your ATM machine. You're just like, what am I going to have? Like 75 cents in there? I mean.
Yeah. Will they even let me access it? Like,
and, you know, the ATM is just like, fuck you. ATM won't even let you access 75 cents. So I was like, what am I going to do? And I remember going to the ATM machine and putting my card in and it said, you have $3,000. What? No.
Did I steal this card?
I was like, wait, that is my card, right? So I cancel it, take the card out, put the card back in. You have $3,000. No. Can't be me. No. You know what? They probably messed it up. We'll just wait a few days. They'll take the money out. Whatever. I'll figure it out. Wait a day, starving. There's no money. There's nothing to eat. I was like, what if I just take like $100 out and then go get this job and then get the money and then just put the $100 back, because it's clearly a mistake, right? To this day, Liz, no one has asked for the $3,000.
Where do you think it, you don't think, how does that happen? Did somebody put it in there?
They must have, I don't know. I always call it my angels looking out for me. I always say, I've been in like some of the worst positions of my life and somehow angels have come and always lifted me and taken care of me. So.
Do you want to hear my equivalent story?
Yes. I love those stories.
This was 8 years ago.
So
I've been doing comedy 18 years, but I've only been full time like 9 years, 8 or 9 years. Like it hasn't been that long. Cause you know, I had a part-time job that kind of kept me afloat. And because it was super part-time, I was able to do comedy and do it. And it was easier to take that risk with this part-time babysitting job and do comedy. So, 8 or 9 years ago, I'm like full time, but I'm like paying my rent $25 gigs at a time, $50 gigs at a time, $100 gigs at a time. Like I'm piecing together rent with tiny money every month. And I'm just like exhausted, da, 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 da. And I'm down to like my last, I think it was $500 or $600. And my rent at the time was $700. So I knew that I would probably be able to make rent that month because I already had $500, $600 and I would make a little bit, but I was screwed. And I was like, all right, well, I need to start looking for jobs soon because I think I'm not going to be able to pay rent soon.
Mm.
So I go to move my car for street cleaning and it's not there.
Mm.
And I'm like, what the fuck? So I'm like, somebody stole my car. So I'm looking everywhere. I'm like, maybe I didn't park here. Da, 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 da. I look up and they had redone. I was on the corner and they just in that week, they had changed certain corners that you couldn't park there, and it was snowy, and I didn't see the little box saying that I couldn't park there, and they towed my car. So I go to pick up my car, and apparently I had parked in that spot for a couple of days because I thought it was a real spot, and I got two parking tickets, and it got towed. It came out to $600. So I pay for all of this. I'm, you know, I find my car, I pick up my car, I pay for my car, I get home. Who knows how many hours that was. I sit down and I hysterically cry. Like, just, I had a month to figure it out, and now I have less than a day. Like, I'm like, fuck, I don't even have rent for this month now. And I'm hysterically crying. And I told myself, I was like, you can cry for an hour and then you have to start looking for jobs. You did your best. It is what it is. And I really like talk like that, you know, looked at myself and I was like, fuck, I'm so fucked. I sit down, I'm about to get ready to look for jobs. And I was like, let me check my email. And I get this email from this woman who's a producer of this tour called The Nobodies of Comedy. And like Jim Gaffigan did this tour before he was famous. Amy Schumer did this tour before she was famous. A bunch of people did it, but it would be four or five comics. They go to these theaters and they do 20 minutes each. And they put this little tour together. And I open up this email and it says, hey, Tony Deo, who's like a friend of mine. He's wonderful. He's been on Conan and stuff. He goes, Tony Deo recommended you for these shows. He said, you'd be a perfect fit. I really like your stuff. I have a couple of gigs coming up. Would you be interested? Yeah. And I was like, yes, absolutely. And she's like, cool. I'll send over the information. She sends over the information. It's in the, so it's like 2 weeks from when this email is, it starts, and it's like $500, $1,000, $500, $2,000. It's like in the matter, all of a sudden it's like six gigs that come out to almost like $5,000. And I was like, I literally was like, you saved me. I was like, yes to all of this. You saved me. Whatever you need. This is amazing. I kind of like almost blabbed my story. Then I called Tony Day. I was like, you're an angel. Oh, Jesus. I was like, I don't even believe in God. I was just like, you came down and you rescued me. And to this day, and like, that was like, and that got me on my feet. And I, not saying I never financially struggled again, but I never got that close again. And I, you know, made clearly better choices, but also like it just got me off that hump of being $25 at a time. Cause not only did I have enough money for that, but I all of a sudden had a little bit of a heads up. I had now had 3 months money. So everything going forward is at least 3 months ahead of time. And it really wasn't until almost 5 years later, I wasn't financially fucked again. Hurry bailed me out of that next one. But it is that kind of like, I tried, I fucked up. It is what it is. This is the end of the road. And then I was like ready to like tail between my legs, figure out something. Like, if I have to fucking work at a hamburger joint, that's what I got to do. And then I get this email with the most money I've ever made. And I was like, da-da-da. I knew it would work out. like I was like, anybody need life advice? I just figured it out.
But you know, I honestly, I don't think that those are kind of, I feel like, you know, it's almost like because we've taken such a big leap of faith, it's the universe is like, I know it doesn't look like I got you, but I got you. Yeah. Like, I know you're going to, and it's interesting you said that I'm going to give myself 1 hour to cry, because that's interesting, because that's what I do with myself. I'm like, okay, I'm going to give myself an hour to cry.
Yeah.
I'm miserable, or like maybe like another 2-3 hours, right? I'm just going to be miserable. All right, I'm not going to eat cookies, but instead I'm going to go for a walk. And if I cry, I'm going to take big sunglasses. I'm just going to cry it out.
Let it out.
Then just come back, just take a deep breath, and we'll just figure it out. And like, it is what it is, right? You just kind of trek along. And like, you know what it is, Liz? And it's exactly that. So I think for my family, they're always like, oh yeah, you're doing this. Like my brother was, the last time my brother was visiting, he wanted to go see Sebastian Maniscalco because he loves Sebastian, right? So he's like, I'm gonna go see Sebastian. I'm like, okay. So we go to the Comedy Store and it's sold out. All the tickets, you try to buy them, they're all sold out, right? Fucking Sebastian. So we show up and my brother's like, oh, well, I go to the show. So my brother, my family always kind of looks at me as like, eh, like she's doing like something. Like, she's
playing make-believe.
They've never watched my comedy, except for my mom. They've never, like, they just don't, right? It's just like, whatever. I'm a whatever to them. So my brother comes over and my brother goes, I'm like, don't worry about it. I'm like, just come to the Comedy Store with me. We'll figure it out. We go to the Comedy Store. Of course, I've been at the Comedy Store for the longest time. It has been my home club in LA. So many people know me. So I walk in and talking to all the guys and everybody. And I'm like, hey, man, you know, I'm talking to one of the guys who's running the room where Sebastian is. And I'm like, hey, man, my brother's visiting and he wants to watch Sebastian. He's like, don't worry about it. I got you. I'll get him a seat. Don't worry about it. No, you don't need to pay nothing. Just come on in. Just order your drinks. And my brother just looked at me like, okay, so you're not like doing some bullshit thing, right?
Yeah.
Like immediately had like respect for me because I could do something for him. You know?
It's well, just also, it's that idea that he loves Sebastian. Where do you think Sebastian started? Where do you think, you know what I mean?
That's right.
Especially with comedy, acting is a little bit different. I think we're slowly finding out more and more that like every actor we know is like their parent was like the head of CBS or like their dad was some kind of casting agent. Like it's almost a little upsetting when you're just like, did everybody come out of the womb of somebody that's already been on television? Comedy is pretty much an equalizer. There's a couple of comedy families, you know, Pauly Shore comes from a comedy family, you know, Ben Stiller comes from a comedy family, but for the most part, there's not this, you know, there's not this Will Smith, Jada Pinkett Smith, where then other celebrities come out of your body. It is, you're nobody, you build something, and you're a comic, and then nothing really happens to your kids are like, why would I ever do that? And then it goes, you know, the Wayans family is like another one, or Chris Rock's family has like their little legends of people. But for the most part, everybody is a nobody. Right. And they start from the ground up. And it's so funny how quickly somebody will be like, oh, I love Jim Gaffigan. You're like, well, Jim Gaffigan was a nobody. And now he's a somebody and now you respect him. Where do you think everybody has to start there? And this belief that they're worthy of your money and support, but I'm not, especially being a family member, is garbage.
That's right. You know, funny story about Jim Gaffigan. This is before I did stand up, right? There's no comedy clubs in Pakistan. I'm not going to a comedy club in Jersey and New York growing up in a conservative Muslim Pakistani household. Like nobody's fucking going to comedy clubs. And I remember the first time I went to a comedy club was Comics Comedy Club, which has since shut down because I also did my first open mic there. I think that's what killed it. The first time I ever got randomly invited to a stand-up comedy show, and who's performing? Jim Gaffigan. And I was like, this guy is so funny. He's hilarious. And come like full circle, last year, there was an article in Forbes that came out, and it's me, Jim Gaffigan, and like one other comic. And I was like, this business is so fucking weird.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
When would I ever imagine like me, like this weird, awkward immigrant person doing comedy, like be on the same place as Jim Gaffigan? Like, who the fuck am I? You know, it's just it's like a mind fuck. But I don't know. You just kind of I feel like it's exactly that. Like whatever you have at home, it's just like it's not that precious. But oh, Sebastian, or oh, Jim Gaffigan, or oh, Liz Mealy. I want to go watch Liz Mealy. You know, but it's and like my brother kept telling me about all the comics that he loves. And refuses to, and simultaneously telling me that he refuses to watch my comedy.
Yeah, I think that's family at this point.
It's just like, what the fuck? Do you have like family? Do your sisters watch your comedy and they're like, Liz, I didn't really like that you talked about this. So can you like not talk about that?
They definitely don't sound like that. it was so insulting.
I don't know why the fuck I just did that voice. I have no idea. Sorry.
It's all good. Everybody's pretty supportive. My brother Greg, is probably the one I'm the least close with, even though we live in the same city. And he's come to shows, but I don't think he's ever been like, "You're funny." He knows Bill Burr likes me and likes my comedy and has retweeted me, and that's the only time that he's like, "That's cool, that's cool." but Sammy used to go on the road with me and is like the funniest person I know and has met a lot of like. I remember I was opening for Chad Daniels, God, like, again, probably like 8 years ago, and Sam came with me, and Chad fell in love with my brother, and they bonded, and they just, like, Chad mentioned my special on his podcast, and he was like, Liz Mealy, super funny. Her brother's really funny. She has a special coming out. And I was like, how did Sammy get the same mention that I did, but I came out with the special? He's like, and it's just so funny that like he just Sam smittens people in a way that I don't think Sam really understands. So he's really supportive. Emily is in LA. She's super supportive. And then Teresa, before she has three kids now. Before she started having kids, her and her husband come out to a lot of shows. So, and then my mom loves my comedy, comes out to shows. I have so many jokes about my mom. And I always ask my mom, I go, hey, is this too much or is this too far? And she's like, you know, if it's funny, it's I'll just pretend it. She goes, if I don't like it, I'll pretend it's somebody else. And I go, Mom, I only have one mom and we have the same face. Like, you know, I could say a friend and it could be any friend, but mom is mom. Like there's nobody else. My dad on the other side, he's really sensitive. And like I said, he's that 50s, you know, keeping up with the Joneses. We don't tell people our business kind of person. So there was a hard rule in the sand that he wasn't allowed to come to any of my shows. Unless like he came to like my first Comedy Central taping because I had to be clean. Yeah. He came to this like Runner's World thing I did because again, it was all running jokes and I had to be clean. But he was like, should I come to your taping? And I was like, I don't think you should. And, you know, this is a really big deal to me. And if you make me feel bad, I'm going to be mad at you. So I don't know if you're going to approve of what I'm talking about. So I think it's best you don't come. And my dad was like, but I want to be supportive. So maybe I could come and put on headphones. I was like, I'm going to have my dad in the crowd looking like a autistic kid wearing headphones in the back of my show. I was like, no, Dad. I was like, you can be a supportive from afar. So he ended up. I was a little worried, but he ended up watching it online and he goes, this is my dad. He goes, it was pretty good. He's like, I was scared, but it was pretty good. And that was like, that was our big, like, we laughed so hard when he said that. I was like, that was probably one of the highest, like, you know, like if like, you know, Dave Chappelle gave you a quote for your stand-up, it would be like Dave Chappelle. And then it would be my dad being like, it was pretty good. And I'd be like, those are on equal level of approval. So, my parents, my whole family, they're in and out of what they accept and don't accept and blah, blah, blah. But for the most part, we are a family that likes comedy. Like I hear about music families where like we all listen to the Beatles and we would sit around the record player, da, da, da. We are a family that like would watch SNL together, or my dad would like tape comics online, or he would like tell me about stuff. Like, so I think we're such a comedy family that this isn't, this probably wasn't the path he chose, but he is, both my parents are kind of like, yeah, it's pretty impressive that she got this far.
That's amazing. Liz, are you guys adopting by any chance? I just want to kind of...
Yeah, no, my parents just retired and they need a project. So.
Oh, that's amazing. I am so much work. They're going to love it.
Yeah, no, they love a project.
I mean, I'm very good at like cleaning up after myself and I can even cook, so they don't have to worry about that part, but I'm totally up for adoption. I just want
Done. I'll put in an application.
They're like, we adopted an immigrant child and... It was already here.
She already had a job. It was great.
We didn't even have to go to Pakistan. She was already here. This is amazing. Oh, my God. Liz, you have, I know you have two specials out right now. We're going to start wrapping up. Where can people, I know you, and are you doing like Zoom shows? By the way, you have that monthly thing that you're doing, right? Where you guys work out your jokes, the diner. Yes. What is it called? Yes. The diner show?
Zoom Diner. So the next Zoom Diner is not this. Today is Thursday. So next Thursday at 7:30. I always say it's pay what you can. Suggest a donation, $5, but you can buy tickets off my website, which is lizmealy.com. And then my first hour and my third hour are free on YouTube. I have a second hour in between. That's an album that's, you know, you can buy it or stream it or whatever, called Mind Over Mealy or Mind Over Melee. And then, what else? Oh, I have a podcast with Maria. So we have a weekly podcast called Two Non-Doctors. And that comes out every Tuesday. We have like, I think 34 episodes. And we talk about our bodies and science and medicine and just a bunch of crap that we don't know anything about that we Googled. And we always just say like, don't listen to us because we're morons. So it's been really good. It's been fun.
That's awesome. What do you mean don't listen to us? Of course they want to listen to you.
No, but like, not because we pick a topic. So like we've had, you know, this week will be bipolar. We've done depression. We've done ADHD. Maria has misophonia. I am dyslexic. She has psoriasis. I have eczema. So we've done all these topics, but all our education is either through experiences or through research online. We're not doctors. So we always like, we'll say stuff, but we're like, don't listen to us. Like listen to us, but don't listen to us. And then we had a lawyer on. We do like guest Googles, and we had a woman that's like a world champion runner and ultra runner, and she's also a lawyer. And we're like, can we get sued by doing this? And she's like, as long as you're not telling people, like, we know what we're talking about. I was like, well, no, every episode we're like, we're morons. Tell us why we're wrong. I'm sure we got it all wrong. So it's a comedy podcast about, you know, health and bodies, but we don't know what the fuck we're talking about. And
and who came up with the title Two Non-Doctors?
It was an inside joke. So because my parents are veterinarians, they're almost my primary doctor. So I'm always showing them rashes first. Almost all my medicine says for cats and dogs only. So I have this innate belief that I know what I'm doing. And then, and Maria is very similar. And then we're also both very curious people. So I would be like, hey, you know, can I put this in this, or is that going to upset my stomach? And she'd be like, I don't know, let's Google it. So it was never like, I don't know. It was always like, I don't know, let's figure it out together. So I remember she was staying with me for 2 months, and she had this really bad rash, and she goes, is this bad? And I was like, it looks really bad, dude. And she was like, how bad? And I was like, I think you should probably go to the doctor. And she's like, I don't know. I was like, dude, as a non-doctor, I would suggest you go. And if you need me to help you pay for it, I'll pay for it. And she goes, well, as a non-doctor, I don't think it's that bad. Like, and we had this fight, and it became this inside joke where, like, I'd be like, dude, my back really hurts. And she's like, as a non-doctor, I think it's because you don't stretch. And like, and we just kind of turned in the fact that we're always giving each other almost poor medical advice. And that's really what it was, is that we had an inside joke. And then I was like, I basically, when the world shut down, I was in London and I had to stop my tour in the middle of it and go home. And I was almost like on a plane being like, we should start a podcast. Like, and that's where it comes from.
And there it is. And listen, what ideal time to start a podcast than friggin' pandemic. Liz Mealy, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this was lovely. I hope we'll bring you back on again soon. And I hope we get to connect again, and maybe you can come and do one of my shows. That'd be awesome too.
I love it. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Liz. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
That was the lovely and amazing Liz Mealy. Hope you guys had a good time. I had a lovely time. Look at that. My background is falling apart. But if you guys haven't followed me on my YouTube channel, you can. You can go to youtube.com/wannashakecomedian. You can go on my Facebook page, same thing, Mona Shea Comedian. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram, Mona's Comedy. Tomorrow, you guys, is a really, really lovely thing that's happening. I am going to be the host of a new, brand new storytelling show at the Comedy Store, which I'm shocked that I get to perform at the Comedy Store. How fortunate of me. My two lovely producers, Betsy Zyko and Felicia Michaels, who are veterans, came out and offered me this gig, and I am going to be hosting this wonderful show at the Comedy Store, where we bring on amazing storytellers. I'm going to be telling a story, and I'm going to be, of course, hosting the entire thing, and it's going to be live streamed on the YouTube channel for the Comedy Store, so you can go and catch me. It's going to be 7 p.m. Pacific. It's going to run for about an hour. And you get to watch me host it, and you get to watch all these amazing, talented storytellers, comedians come and tell their stories. So, but tomorrow, I have my podcast tomorrow at 4:30 p.m. because I need to do it earlier so I can wrap it up and then head over to do another live stream. You guys are fantastic. I love and adore you guys. Thank you very much for tuning in. I will see you tomorrow, 4:30 Pacific, and hopefully I will catch you at the Comedy Store hosting show as well.